I'll show you politics in America. Here it is, right here. I think the puppet on the right shares my beliefs. I think the puppet on the left is more to my liking. Hey, wait a minute. There's one guy holding up both puppets. Shut up. Go back to bed, America. Your government is in control.
Read my lips.
Just send your cash.
There has never been so many lies, so much deception.
Doesn't anyone notice this? I feel like I'm taking crazy pills.
Please clap.
It's time for the Mike Madison Show, a new breed of conservative talk. Now, here's your host, Mike Madison.
Showtime! Woo!
All right, good morning. Welcome to the Mike Madison Show here at 103.9 WYAB, providing a safe space to you independent thinkers out there 2 hours a day. I appreciate you joining me. Also joining me today will be Stephen Utroska with Americans for Prosperity. I just get more and more involved with Americans for Prosperity on different issues and more impressed by the organization. This is kind of the people's lobbyist when it comes to economic freedom, and those economic freedoms are under assault. And so it's good to have the organization there. So we'll have Stephen in for the second hour of the show today. I've got what I think is maybe my favorite quote that I've seen in quite a while from Kierkegaard. But I guess I'll start it off by playing this first clip here that really kind of highlights what the quote is about. This was like they're starting a race. Is on live television. I'm not sure if this is a NASCAR race or exactly what it is. It's a NASCAR type event. Some kids are asked to do the traditional gentlemen start your engines, and one of the kids added a little something.
They're going to help kick this thing off. All right, guys, ready? In 3, 2, 1.
Drivers, start your engines.
Let's go, Brandon.
The kid audio bombs the segment with a "Let's go, Brandon." I tell you what, I love it. I love it, and it leads me into today's quote of the day, which is Soren Kierkegaard. He said, "The only intelligent tactical response to life's horror is to laugh defiantly at it." The only intelligent tactical response to life's horror is to laugh defiantly at it. I am especially good at that, particularly in my personal life. Now, a lot of things we cover on this show are serious. I get mad at it. But the reason I love Let's Go Brandon is because it is funny. It is upbeat, although the message is certainly serious, which is we have no respect for the president of the United States right now. And I'm so happy. It took getting Joe Biden, one of the probably go down in history as the worst president of the United States in our history. It took electing the Democratic mind addled, demented, corrupt fool Joe Biden to get everybody over onto my side where we just show absolute disrespect for the president of the United States. I've been showing that disrespect for that office for just about 2 decades now. So I'm very glad to have all my fellow travelers now who understand that it's almost at this point, it's dangerous to have somebody running this country because we've allowed the government to get so powerful. They're wielding such a big weapon against so many of us. So the only intelligence response to life's horror, whether it's Joe Biden, whether it is the COVID regime and the COVID cultists, is to just laugh defiantly at it. I have said that I think the only thing that has kept me really upbeat over the past year has been memes. I mean, the memes, and I'll hand it to you people on the right. You're funny as hell. The memes that are coming out of the right over the past 18 months, whether it's COVID or politics, are absolutely hilarious. There's so many clever people out there. It's why I love being a libertarian, because I understand that if we actually took politics out of our lives because these people didn't matter to us anymore, they shouldn't matter to us now. If we took the political class out of our lives, we would have such a good time. I got to tell you, this would be such a great country. We'd be upbeat. We'd be laughing and joking. Oh, yeah, sure. There'd be problems. Human beings are always going to have problems. But I think we would take care of it. I talk a lot about ending the drug war. You know, there's all this talk about gun violence and all these kinds of things. If you want to get rid of gun violence in the United States, you do two things. You end the drug war. You take away the black market. Prohibition in the 1920s is the example. You had safe streets in Chicago, and then you outlawed alcohol. So gangs started selling alcohol and shooting it out in the streets for territory. And then you removed alcohol prohibition, and the gangs, at least the liquor gangs at the time, they went away and Chicago became safe again. Now the Democrats took it over in the 70s and it is where it is. Now they are putting up gunshot treatment kits all over the city. So there's that. But even that violence in Chicago is largely driven by the drug war dummies. You've created a gang culture that derives its money and power from selling black market drugs. End the black market. Legalize freedom, even the freedom to do stupid things like take drugs. You do that and you take our kids in the schools off of psychotropic drugs, get them off of antidepressants and ADHD medications, which every one of the school shooters are on, and you'd see about a 90% reduction in gun crime. Those two things right there. President Mike Madison does those two things. If I become the benevolent dictator of the United States at some point, I end the drug war, I get our kids off these mass medications. 90% of gun crime goes away. And politics is kind of the same thing. You want to see people start getting along again. You want to see us return to some level of civility. Take the politics out of the country. Just take these control freak, the race hustlers, the race pimps who get political power. Get them out of there. Get our politics out of our lives. We are the shining hill, the shining free market, productive country that we always should be. People do not understand this. Instead, this is my frustration of watching people line up on either side of the aisle and fight for their team. Your team is destroying this country. I don't even care what team it is. Yeah, the Democrats are worse. You're right. But it is politics itself in this country that has become so toxic. And the intrusion of government in our lives is what angers so many of us all the time anyway. Whether it's jamming a needle in your arm or stripping you of half of your income every year. It is these people, the parasite class. We get them out of here. I'm telling you, I just fixed the United States right there in my opening segment. Get rid of the drug war. Get our kids off mass medications and start laughing hysterically at these people who think they control our lives. Now, we have to have a lot of people that do that. Just one person laughing at this system can find themselves under the heel of it. But if we would do those three things right there, you wouldn't recognize America. Be one of the just the best quality of life on planet Earth. When I come back, a couple of stories. Alex Berenson put out a tweet. He's been covering COVID stuff, and he put out a tweet, a really sad tweet. I went to University of Georgia for 2 years. Then I went to Mississippi State after that because I didn't excel academically at University of Georgia, but I did excel socially. I did really well socially at University of Georgia, but my parents were not down with paying for out-of-state tuition for a robust social life, so they thought I could do robust social in-state tuition-wise. Anyway, I went to University of Georgia. They've lost a student there. Alex Berenson talks about it. I'm going to dissect that story. It also leads us into a story about some attorneys who are actually taking some action around this COVID mess. I'm looking anywhere I can find. I want to see some activity. I know we make a lot of fun of lawyers, don't we? Lawyers may be the ones that save us in the end. I am looking for any legal action against mandates, against anything that has been around this COVID narrative. I think attorneys are one of the last lines in the sand we've got before we completely go totalitarian. So I'll bring you a story about that when we come back. Stay with me. You know, the knock on talk show hosts is we talk about the problems, we never give solutions. This is a big problem. Of course, solutions usually will involve people getting involved and active, and that's really where we fall down, isn't it? You know who you are. You're mad about the CRT in your schools. You're mad about the mask. You don't want to see vaccine mandates. Have you been to a school board meeting? Yeah, I didn't think so. That's no knock. I mean, look, this is new. This is taking back control of our institutions is a muscle that has atrophied over the years. Certainly over the last 40, 50, 60, 70 years when Americans got nice and comfortable, we really just let our guard down and we see what we have allowed to come in. But you want some solutions. I'm gonna back up this Alex Berenson piece and what these attorneys are doing for just a second. I'm going to show you how easy it is to fix America. So I've said you end the drug war. This is a tough one for conservatives. I know that. They fearmonger drugs the same way they fearmonger COVID. Mike, if we got rid of the drug war, we'd just be stepping over junkies all over the place. Other countries have done it. That has not been the case. They fearmongered you about having casinos in Mississippi. We would degenerate into some unrecognizable state of a den of iniquity. Did it happen? No, it didn't. Understand you were controlled by fear. Conservatives, you're controlled by a lot of fear. You're controlled by the fear of Muslims. Many people believe that the Muslims are coming to take your stuff. And you're supposed to forget that we've been bombing them and overthrowing their governments for the last 60 years in imposing our strongmen dictators on them. We're supposed to forget all that and think it's just this religious ideology that makes them want to slit all of our throats. So everybody's controlled by fear. So here's your solutions. If you could ever get over the fear, if Americans could ever get over the fear and embrace freedom and understand that life is not perfect, I can't paint a picture where there is no tragedy in the United States. That never will happen in any society at any time. In my most utopian libertarian society, where there is almost zero government, there would still be tragedy and unfortunate things. But if you haven't noticed, tragedy and unfortunate things happen even with a huge government, so you're not losing anything. I think you gain a lot. So my prescription is you end the drug war. Conservatives, at some point, you'll wrap your head around that. I don't know how long it takes. We're 50 years into a really strong, robust drug war, and a lot of conservatives still think we just haven't done enough. You end the drug war. You end the mass medication of our children. You end the tax regime. Let Americans keep what they want, but the key to that is ending the Federal Reserve. You get rid of the central bank. You go back and you back our dollar by something tangible like gold. You end the war on terror. And you do these things, you get politicians out of our lives. America's fixed. No more inflation. Oh, there'll be some supply and demand crunches and prices and spikes that maybe of things that are popular. But you won't have wholesale inflation and just that mass devaluation of your dollar. So do you understand there's about five things you could do. United States would be unrecognizable and in the throes of tremendous prosperity and happiness. You end gun violence with the first two. Ending the drug war, ending the mass medication of our children. The drug war is the biggie. The mass medication is really just to the school shootings, which are so horrific and lead to the calls for gun control instead of what should be antidepressant control. You end the Federal Reserve. You end the war on terror. End the empire. Everybody's tried it, but conservatives, again, I'm talking mostly to conservatives. Don't think I'm picking on you. I told you, I want to do a show on a liberal radio station. But I'm talking largely to conservatives. Conservatives have been convinced that the United States needs to be all over the world because if we're not there, the whole place erupts into chaos and then they're going to come across the oceans en masse and take our stuff. It's just not true. Plenty of countries in Europe can defend themselves. I don't think there's enough wealth in Europe that we don't have to be toting the bill for NATO. They can defend themselves. Switzerland is a landlocked country. They got people all around them. Isn't it odd that they've never been invaded? Isn't it odd that there's nobody in the Middle East chanting death to Switzerland? Why is that? They're very wealthy. You would think if anybody is just arbitrarily going to swoop in and take somebody's stuff, little Switzerland would certainly be a target. It would be rampaged, once every 20 years. People would swoop in, take all the stuff from the Swiss, and then leave. We've got two giant oceans on either side of us and two friendly neighbors. They're not coming to take our stuff. We need to end the empire, which is part of end the war on terror. That's a prescription for the restoration of America. Right there. Instead, the Republicans will, you know, tinker around the edges. They're going to tell you they're going to let you keep 3% more of your money, and you cheer for them. You think, oh, that'll fix it. They talk about all the new economic activity of letting you have 3% more of your money, and the Republicans cheer. No, real freedom. A real tax cut, meaning get the Fed out of our pockets. These kinds of things, they would... But you understand why these things are not talked about by your political class? Because that's essentially them saying, we're going to give up all of our power. You end the Federal Reserve, you put us on a gold standard. Congress critters don't have $6 trillion a year in budgeted money to give out to the swamp. It doesn't exist. You let the American people keep every nickel they have, then Republicans, and I'm picking on Republicans because most of you have probably voted for largely Republican. Republicans don't have, you know, they don't have things like Medicare Part D, where they gave this huge benefit to the pharmaceutical companies by giving essentially free drugs to senior citizens. Do you know how that works? Do you know the mechanism behind that? Well, here's what the Republicans did. The Republicans who told you they are for small, limited government, constitutionally created, they set up a system under George W. Bush and a Republican Congress to essentially cost shift, prescription drugs for the sickest among us, which is the elderly. And instead of the elderly having to pay the drugs, the government said, oh, we'll pay for all the drugs. We will take money from the taxpayer. And then we'll just give it to the pharmaceutical companies and they'll ship off some pills to the old people. You know how they wouldn't have been able to get away with doing that if there was no Federal Reserve endlessly printing up money and they weren't in your pockets. See how that works? So the pharmaceutical companies gave tons of money to the Republicans to get Medicare Part D passed. And the only way they could do it was because the Republicans could spend money they didn't have and the money that they take out of your pocket. So you end the Federal Reserve, you end the income tax. They can't do those things. Suddenly the pharmaceutical companies have to compete. Yeah, yep, they'd have to compete. They'd have to have good drugs at reasonable prices that senior citizens could afford and if they wanted them. Of course, I would tell you, you don't need all those pharmaceuticals. You get your nutrition. And I wouldn't mandate anything, you know, on nutrition stuff. I would just take care of those core problems that I've just listed off and everything else would take care of itself. But people believe you need these politicians. You need to look at their platform, see which one you agree with more. And you Democrats. Oh, you Democrats. Take an economics lesson, please. Take me out for a cup of coffee. I'll explain to you why your harebrained ideas will never work. I love a good liberal heart that wants to see everybody do well, that hates homelessness. I despise homelessness. I think it is sick that our society allows people to be sleeping on the streets, particularly our veterans. You understand you've got a psychopathic group of people in Washington, D.C. that will take young men and women now, ship them off halfway around the world for no good reason, no national security reason, destroy their lives, destroy their minds, and when they come home, they'll just let them sleep on the streets in their own filth. Do you understand? That's what happens in Washington, D.C. So you liberals who are against homelessness, against tragedy, against just all of these things, because you've got a good heart, I am right there with you. And boy, could good, compassionate Americans solve a lot of these problems. There's plenty of good charities out there, all kinds of things, and so much more effective. But you want the government to do it. It doesn't matter. It's like the war on drugs, the education department. It doesn't matter how many decades of failure you have. For some reason, the Americans are of this mind that we just haven't quite done enough. We just spend 10% more on education. I think that'll do it. This is what we say. If we just lock up 10% more people, I think we'll win this war on drugs. If we just drop 10% more bombs around the world, I think we'll wrap this up. We just didn't do enough in Afghanistan. They need to unleash the generals to win a war. Everybody thinks these politicians, it's not that they made a massive mistake and we never should have done any of these things in the first place. It's just that we didn't do enough. We got to do a little bit more. It's not hard to fix this country. I just did it. Took me, with a commercial break, about 21 minutes. Most of these things will never be tried because most of the Americans don't understand them. They've never heard that kind of stuff before. So it's sad. It's frustrating. It's frustrating when you've got all the answers, isn't it? People know this. Sometimes you see people having struggles in their lives, and you want to tell them, I know this is what you need to do. I feel this way sometimes about nutrition stuff. Oh, you know, they're suffering from chronic conditions. I know what you need to do. You need to quit making pita pockets or hot pockets your main dietary staple. So it's frustrating when you know what people need to do and they just refuse to do it. It's very frustrating for people like me, the libertarians, the real freedom people, because you can't want the things that I'm saying, well, telling you will fix America if you really don't believe in freedom. And most people believe in freedom only in kind of a passive way. You believe in some freedoms, but not other freedoms. You got to draw a line. We need some people in charge to draw a line between certain freedoms, right? I mean, you shouldn't be allowed to plunge a needle into my arm, but you should be allowed to lock my neighbor in a cage because he smoked a plant on his back porch. That kind of thing. It's kind of weird to me. Doesn't seem real consistent. No one's explained to me how it's consistent, but, you know, real freedom would really, it would restore this country. So there you go. There's the prescription. Some candidate, take it, run with it. I won't hold my breath. I'll be right back. All right, we are back. This is the Mike Madison Show, 103.9 WYAB. If you're just tuning in, I fixed the entire country in my five-point plan. Pretty simple stuff. I wanted to get into this. Alex Berenson shared a story. He is a former New York Times reporter who is actually good. He's an investigative journalist, and so, of course, the New York Times couldn't have that. So they let him go, and now he's publishing on Substack. But he's been covering, he covers a lot of interesting things. He's kind of along the lines of a Glenn Greenwald type guy. He's not really playing the establishment media games. He's trying to stick to kind of old reporting and actually investigating stuff. He shared a story, a very sad story, of a University of Georgia student who died of COVID-19 complications, is what the story is reading. I'm going to suggest something differently. Sean Kuhn, a senior majoring in exercise and sports science at the University of Georgia, passed away on October 11th after battling COVID-19-based pneumonia for about 6 weeks. He worked as a certified personal trainer at UGA, had a job, worked at Chick-fil-A, where he was team leader, and his aim was to become a certified physical therapist. Charlotte Brooke Kuhn, Sean Kuhn's older sister, said he was, anyone, fully vaccinated. So here's the thing about that. There's been warnings why a healthy 21-year-old who is obviously extremely physically fit, he's a certified physical therapist, you can see pictures of him, he's young and very healthy. The vaccines, the big warning that came from the censored scientists, the censored doctors, the censored pharmaceutical whistleblowers, they came out and said, we're warning about this antibody-dependent enhancement, meaning if you take this shot and then you are exposed to the virus in the wild, then the same fate could befall you that befell the ferrets that they tested mRNA vaccines on years ago, where they all got extremely sick and many of them died because of something called antibody-dependent enhancement. So there's a very good chance that this Sean Kuhn would still be alive today had he been fighting it with his natural immune system, which certainly appeared to be robust. Now, the problem with a lot of these things is we're trying to prove a negative. There's just almost no way to know if COVID would have gotten him anyway. But for his age demographic, the odds were eternally in his favor, and it is a known side effect of these vaccines, this antibody-dependent enhancement that probably made it extremely bad for him, made it worse. That will never be reported that way. But there are attorneys out there. I wanted to highlight this because I think the attorneys could save the world. And I know that's kind of a bitter pill. We've spent so much time making fun of attorneys. And there's a lot of them that are cowards and do things that are, you know, I've been in the legal system. It is a rigged game as far as who's making money. They make everything as difficult as possible to make sure you have to engage the legal community. And boy, that can be expensive and unrewarding. But anyway, attorneys are the ones that may stop vaccine mandates. Attorneys are the ones that may stop some of these things. So there's an attorney that has written a letter to the CDC and the FDA on behalf of a doctor who has been raising alarms about vaccine side effects. She is not getting any response from the CDC or the FDA. Again, this is an MD, a medical doctor, who did. She was a good little girl. She did what the government said, and she inoculated a bunch of her patients. And then she started to see problems. And so she contacted the FDA and the CDC, and you'd think they might be kind of interested in that since this is an experimental shot. You know, I'm no scientist, but I believe with testing comes some monitoring. So she reached out to the CDC and the FDA. And I'm going to read you a little bit of this letter that the attorney has sent. So she's now hired an attorney to be her go-between, to force some kind of acknowledgement of her claims from these bodies that should be monitoring this vaccine program. This letter is directed to Dr. Peter Marks, the director of the CBER at the FDA, and to Tom Shinamakuru, the CDC COVID-19 Vaccine Task Force. You would think that someone with the head of the Vaccine Task Force, might be interested to know what's going on with the vaccine itself, but apparently he's been unresponsive to this doctor. I read from the letter. We write with regard to September 28, 2021, letter sent to you by Dr. Patricia Lee, an ICU physician and surgeon who has observed and treated numerous COVID-19 vaccine-injured patients. Despite the serious harms from the COVID-19 vaccines detailed by Dr. Lee, you have failed to respond to Dr. Lee's concerning letter, nor has anyone reached out to her for additional information regarding these harms, the patients, or her concerns. Now, even if you are out there pro-vax and you think this thing is going to save us all, I'm not sure what you're looking at to come to that conclusion, but even so, wouldn't you want a doctor, an MD, part of the medical establishment, wouldn't you want the CDC or the FDA to communicate with her if there's a problem? Don't you want somebody watching this, particularly if you've got children and they're about to roll this thing out on them? Don't you want the CDC and the FDA to be investigating any potential side effects? Or you just think that Pfizer would never steer us wrong? I read more from this letter. Dr. Lee's experience does not comport with your agency's claims of safety regarding COVID-19 vaccines. She has been an ICU physician and surgeon for over 15 years and, in that time, has not seen vaccine injuries at the rate she has seen from COVID-19 vaccines. Dr. Lee did not reach out about redness at the injection site. The injuries she is observing include entirely healthy individuals suffering serious, often fatal injuries, including, and I want you to keep in mind as I read you this list, this is one doctor. This is one doctor in the entire United States. What are we? I think we have 600,000 physicians. Is that number right? Maybe more than that. I don't know. This is one of them. The injuries she is observing include entirely healthy individuals suffering serious, often fatal injuries, including transverse myelitis resulting in quadriplegia, pneumocystis pneumonia, multi-system organ failure, cerebral venous sinus thrombosis, postpartum hemorrhagic shock and septic shock, and disseminated CMV and CMV viremia. This letter goes on to say, Dr. Lee's clinical observations are particularly troubling because, as she explains, quote, it appears statistically improbable that any one physician should witness this many COVID-19 vaccine injuries if the Federal Health Authority claims regarding COVID-19 vaccine safety were accurate. And that she has, quote, spoken with colleagues who have also had similar experiences. This is one doctor She's got these concerns. She's seeing it. She's doing what she's supposed to do, right? Contact the people that are supposed to be monitoring this program. They won't even respond to her. And she says she has got colleagues that are seeing exactly the same thing. But this brave doctor, Dr. Lee, Dr. Patricia Lee, has hired counsel to make sure her concerns are heard. This letter finishes up with, "Your failure to respond is highly concerning. Please contact us forthwith so we can arrange a discussion and information gathering session between Dr. Lee and the appropriate representatives at the CDC and FDA. As noted by Dr. Lee, we hope the focus will not be on her, but rather on the harms to her patients. We look forward to your immediate reply." What does it say? I've never been so proud of my body of work since I came to this radio station, where I have blown the whistle on the CDC and the FDA now for 5 years, long before COVID was even a twinkle in Anthony Fauci's eye. These bodies, they're not there to protect you. They don't care about you. Now, I don't know if this is a plan to depopulate the planet, but sure as hell feels like it. But the fact that they will ignore these things, and again, when you stop and think about the fact this is one doctor, and I gave you that list, what she's seen. This is one doctor who has seen healthy individuals suffering serious, often fatal injuries, including transverse myelitis, resulting in quadriplegia. Can you even imagine? Can you even imagine being forced by your employer or even just being enthusiastic about getting the shot and suddenly you're a quadriplegic? This is what she's witnessed. This is her patient. Pneumocystis, pneumonia, multi-system organ failure, cerebral venous sinus thrombosis, postpartum hemorrhagic shock and septic shock, and disseminated CMV and CMV viremia. That's one doctor has experienced those things, and she says her colleagues have experienced the same things. CDC and FDA doesn't care. We'll see where this goes. We had the show yesterday about some legislators in Oregon, that are demanding that some new accounting be done about COVID-19 case fatalities, about vaccine adverse events, that they actually get some honesty to those numbers. The people in charge don't want any honesty. They want no transparency. They are covering this stuff up. And to anybody who believes that's some kind of a conspiracy theory, and I have friends, if I just said that statement to them, they would say, "Oh, that's ridiculous." Well, this is a doctor represented by an attorney that is telling you right now that she is desperately trying to raise alarm bells, trying to raise a red flag, say we got a problem here, and the people that are in charge of this vaccination program are not even responsive to her. If you don't call that a cover-up, I'm not sure exactly what you call it.
At first I was afraid, I was petrified. I kept thinking I could never live without you by my side. But then I spent so many nights just thinking how you'd done me wrong. I grew strong. I learned how to get along. And so
all right, we are back, and we are now joined by Stephen Utroska from Americans for Prosperity. Stevens, thanks for coming in.
Always glad to be on.
So we've got some news on medical marijuana. We'll talk about next hour, and then we're gonna talk. I want to talk to Stephen about something that we talked about in the Grassroots Leadership Academy the other day. About the way to approach legislators to get things done, and so we'll talk about kind of the strategy stuff. It was kind of interesting listening. There was some. It wasn't disagreement. It was frustration by some of the people that, you know, who aren't in the world like you are. And so anyway, I'll just leave it at that. That's the worst tease I've ever done on radio. But it's about the relationship between us and our what feels like overlords. And y'all are good at that stuff. And I think people could use the advice. You gave some good advice at that thing the other day. And so we'll talk a little bit about that. I've been talking a little bit about the vaccine injuries. And this was just another kind of gross story, Silicon Valley. I wanted to read this to you, that GoFundMe, apparently, there's a woman who was fighting the vaccine mandates. Apparently, she got fired or quit. Let me see here. A former registered nurse, last name is Bridges, nurse at Houston Methodist Hospitals, fired after refusing to comply with the hospital's vaccine requirements. She raised more than $180,000 for her lawsuit before being shut down under the company's misinformation policy. Heidi Hagberg, a spokesman for GoFundMe, said in a statement to Business Insider that when our team initially reviewed the fundraiser, it was within our terms of service as the funds were for legal fees to fight vaccine mandates. The fundraiser has since been updated to include misinformation, which violates our terms of service. The story says what's striking about this latest ban is that the courts are the place for such claims to be weighed in a neutral and dispassionate form. Misinformation can be addressed by judges. It goes into this stuff. Again, this is just, I mean, Silicon Valley, the censorship that we're seeing right now, this inability for people to access platforms just and I'll let Stephen weigh in on this. I already know where he's going to come to. And I'm like you. It is the cultural, I guess, the it's not so I wouldn't want to force GoFundMe to do this. I just find it really interesting that so many companies are on this misinformation, labeling things that, you know, are subjective at best. But the Silicon Valley has come in to act like the arbiter of all truth and are just stripping people arbitrarily, but only on one side of the issue.
Yeah, well, you know, I think that the more I've thought about this, and I'm not saying that my opinions have changed, but I think they developed some because of the federal mandate coming out, because of Joe.
Yeah.
You know, at least, you know, I don't know if that's even legal. I don't know if, you know, I've seen lots of things saying that what he said isn't even an executive order yet. You know,
it's so, not.
However you look at that, though, I mean, if the federal government's coming down and saying that businesses have to do mandates, you know, I'm against the states coming out on the other side and saying that it is illegal for a private company to do it. But I do think the state has the not only the authority, but they have you know, it is part of the role of government to protect the rights of citizens and businesses, which are owned by citizens.
Right.
So I think that the state government is right in coming out and saying, no, we're protecting our citizens. We're protecting our businesses
from the federal government.
From the federal overreach.
Right.
That's right. So, you know, like Texas came out and said, no, you know, state, you know, businesses in the state of Texas don't have to, you know, listen to this federal mandate because it's an overreach. So you don't have to do that.
Right.
And so, you know, I support that.
Yeah.
You know, that side of it. And that's kind of different. That leads really into a different branch of the conversation that you and I have had before on the air, whether, you know, I think states can outlaw mandates on the private side. I don't think that they should be able to outlaw private mandates. But if we're fighting the federal government and overreach, I think that they can and should protect their businesses and their citizens by saying, no, you don't have to, you know, listen to this federal overreach.
Well, Tate came out with a statement. I think this was this yesterday. He was asked the question or something about the lack of healthcare workers, and he made this incredibly weak, half-hearted thing. I mean, he's accurate, but he said, I think they're just exacerbating their problems by doing these vaccine mandates. But he has, doesn't he have at least, and I'm with you, I don't want Tate to come out and say that private businesses can't do it. But when you look at UMC, I don't know how many people they ended up firing, but I mean, he always could have come out and said, don't do this. These are the heroes out there mandating this. Let these nurses make their own decisions. The doctors make their own decisions. He's been completely silent on that, hasn't he?
Right. Yes, he has. Well, and that's the thing. You know, there's you and I can argue about whether the government should do this or government do that through government action.
Right.
But for him to be a leader,
right,
for him to be an elected leader, for, you know, him to be the sole elected, you know, head of the state of Mississippi, because the people of Mississippi felt that he was, you know, at least the best that they had to choose from, for him to stand up.
I think they're rethinking
that. Yeah, well, I agree with you. But at least for him to stand up, even if he's not using executive action or any power of the state, for him to at least say up and say, I think that's a bad idea.
Yeah, well, I mean, he has got his own citizens. These are Mississippians that he professes to love and want to represent and take care of.
And protect.
Yeah, and protect. He's got Mississippians that are having their careers stripped from him. I mean, and I'm with you. I'm not talking about him doing an executive order like Greg Abbott did. But to come out and say, I don't want to see people in my state lose their jobs. I mean, they may have to move out of the state. For him to just stay completely mum on this, is it Thomas Dobbs' sway on him that gets him fearful of that?
I think Thomas Dobbs has sway on him in many more areas other than just the mandates and vaccines and COVID-19. And we'll talk about it next hour. But I think he's got sway in the medical marijuana fight, too.
Oh, dear.
That is delaying this issue.
Oh, my gosh. Wow. Okay. Well, yeah, that's a good tease. I want to hear more about that. Thomas Dobbs is a nightmare. I would love to see. Have there ever been any opinion polls of Thomas Dobbs in the state? Does anybody run those kinds of things? Could y'all do that?
I think that there have been polls run. They're private polls, though. They have not been made public.
Oh, okay. So any insight? You're smiling over there like you know. Anything you can break here? Is he popular?
He's not a very popular guy.
I would think not. I mean, in the state that has wrestled with these things, and obviously Tate Reeves does better politically in the state when he errs on the side of freedom. I mean, people have been proud of him when he was one of the first that stopped mandatory lockdowns and things. So we know that that's popular in this state. So Thomas Dobbs is completely counter to that. He cannot be popular in this state.
Yeah, you'd be surprised how many polls are run in the state about a variety of different things. And every once in a while, we'll run polls, but every once in a while, some of our friends will run polls that you would never expect somebody to do, and we'll get the inside story on it.
So. Oh, man, that's actually very interesting. Yeah, okay. All right, well, we'll talk about that. I definitely want to hear Thomas Dobbs' involvement. This is the Thomas Dobbs outrage show, as far as I'm concerned. I saw him at the gym. I'm almost positive I saw him at the gym. I couldn't tell. He had a huge mask on. He didn't carry around the sanitary bottle to wipe down his stuff.
No, man.
How about that? Yep. All right. We'll be back next hour, Freedom and Prosperity Hour. Stephen Utroska, stay with us. All right, we are back. This is the Mike Madison Show, 103.9 WYAB, and it's Thursday, so we do our Freedom and Prosperity Hour. We're here with Stephen Utroska from Americans for Prosperity, the people's lobbyist out there. Is that a good description
That's
of what
it.
Y'all do?
Okay. We are the people's lobbyist.
Yeah. You need a raised clenched fist somewhere in the logo. You got a torch, don't you?
Yeah, we got a torch.
A clenched fist holding up the torch. Add
I like to say we're
to
public interest lobbyists.
Public interest lobbyists. All right. Stephen and I just came as close as we've ever come to a fist fight here in the studio off air as we debate the way to actually get things done through a legislative process. I'm not sure what order to put our stuff in today, but now that I've actually said this out loud, I'm fired up again, so we're going to talk about it.
I think I could take you, though.
We're going to find out if you start hearing rumbles and the mic sounds like they fall, it's on. And whoever wins can come back to the mic and take the rest of the
hour.
Yeah,
there we go. We'll know who won.
Right. So at the meeting on Tuesday, you guys gave some advice about how to get effect change at the legislative level.
Right.
And a lot of it was based around the idea, and God, I tell you, when I say this term, it starts to make me angry, but it's called playing the game. So I think in this little exchange we'll have right now, I'll advocate for kind of my side, which is the frustrated American side, and you can advocate for what you know to be effective because you do this for a living. So you have expertise in this that I don't have. So I would never say you're wrong. I think my main thing is, so your thinking is essentially when you want to get something done with the legislature, you need to approach them with some level of respect and calmness and make your case, and you believe that they are open to that. Certainly better. And granted, I have done this show, particularly during the Trump years, saying if you are out there screaming at people on Facebook and screaming at people on Twitter, you are doing nothing but making them more firm in their opposition to you. I think this yelling at other private citizens is ridiculous. It accomplishes nothing. You and I already kind of think alike, and I can take that same concept and approach it to and apply it to the legislature that you need to go be calm, be respectful, all of these other things. The only thing that, and I think even from us talking now, you see this, the frustration of the people, which is we feel like we are being bowed to this political class, that they know they have this power. And even though they've let us down time and time again, they're telling us we can't express any outrage about that because they'll really show us then. So we need to come hat in hand, groveling to them, kissing their butts to make them pretty, pretty, pretty please do what we want, you know, that kind of thing. And the medical marijuana issue, which we'll talk about in a second, is the biggest example of that. You have had hundreds of people across the state for 12 months at the cost of millions of dollars and great effort to get a thing on the ballot, get it voted on, have it win, all of these other things. And then when it's time for it to be implemented, it's derailed by the political class. Now it's back in their hands again, and they're dicking around with it. So, yeah. You know, people are frustrated with this class. And when you tell a private citizen who is sick of watching the way politicians have failed us, manipulated us, and the corruption that's in that system, when you tell them to go up and be polite, that's a tough sell.
Yeah, I understand that. And you know, I'm not saying at all that you need to go up there and kiss the ring. That's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is even before I got involved with Americans for Prosperity, and I was just a concerned constituent, that's what I told people all the time. Oh, are you a lobbyist? No, I'm just a concerned constituent. I'm up here to talk to people because I believe in changing it. But what I found was, didn't matter what side they're on, Republican, Democrat, my legislator, some legislator from 200 miles away in the state, if I would go up to the Capitol and I would reach out to them and say, hey, look, you and I may not agree on this topic, but I would love for us to have a cordial conversation about it. And I always tried to use the word cordial when I reach out to them. I'd love to have a cordial conversation with you so that we can sit down. We may disagree, but I'd love to hear your side of it. You just hear the facts that I have. And I think it's very important when you talk to somebody about a topic, whether it's about medical marijuana or whether it's about mandates or whatever, everybody loves to have a story connected to it. And a story can certainly pull at kind of the heartstrings of politicians and show them why it matters to you, but you can't only have that. You also have to have facts with it. And so if you go to them and say, hey, look, here are the facts, and this is why I feel so strongly about this, and then you have a cordial conversation with them, they're more than open to talk. They're more than open to at least hear you and listen to you. But when you come up to them, shouting at them, yelling at them, threatening them, they just shut down. They don't want to hear anything. They don't want to hear your stories.
Yeah,
they don't want to hear
facts. That.
They don't want to hear anything.
They're human beings.
Right, they are. And so that's the point that we're trying to make. I know you have the lizard people, right?
Right, yeah, exactly.
But no, I mean, most of them are very sensible, very cordial individuals if you come at them from a cordial side yourself. And so if you say, hey, I want to talk. Now, you can disagree. You can say, hey, here are the facts, from reputable doctors or whatever, if you're talking about this. Reputable people who have given facts. This is what they say. This is the research that shows that, and this is why it matters to me. Most of them will at least hear you, hear the facts, and then they can take that back and digest it. If you go up there and yell and scream and do all this, threaten them, they just shut down.
Okay. Well,
and they don't want to talk to you in the future about anything else. So even if you go to them and say, hey, let's have a cordial conversation about this, at the end of the conversation, they can say, hey, look, thank you for coming in, but I respectfully disagree with you, and you haven't swayed me. That's fine. Again, don't yell at them then. Just say, well, thank you so much for taking time to talk to me now. And in the future, they are more than willing to talk to you again. But if you go up that first time, you're yelling, you're cussing, you're screaming at them or whatever, they will shut down and they'll remember you and not ever want to talk to you again. So when you do find something that maybe you can sway them on, you've already lost them.
Okay. So that's on the individual legislator area. And this applies to everything. It applies
right.
to city councils. It would apply to the mayor's office in your town. So this we're talking about trying to affect change through dialoguing with representatives. Here's the next stage of that that is especially frustrating to people, and it's when you start getting into the politics within politics, which is you can go to your legislature, plead your case, and even if you win there, then all of a sudden this thing goes to some committee with a committee head who was appointed by the Speaker of the House, and the Speaker of the House, his motivation is something completely different.
Yep.
He's got pressures on him from lobbyists, from deals he's made with other people. So suddenly you've swayed somebody, you've made your impassioned thing, and then you're up against this brick wall where a Speaker of the House is going to let something die in committee for political reasons, for money or corruption reasons. And so that frustration, I mean, I don't think Americans have got the patience. Things are getting
sure.
bad for us.
Now, and we do this too. So Americans Prosperity does this, and I think that anybody can do this, and they should do this, is when they take a vote or they make an action, if a chairman doesn't bring a bill up in his committee and lets it die, it's on him.
Right.
He makes that decision. So then you make that known. I mean, there's nothing wrong with educating people in the public about what's going on at the Capitol. That's what I do every time I come on. I'm talking about what's going on in the Capitol, what certain politicians are doing. I'm letting people know. I'm educating people about it. So especially if he's your legislator and he takes a bad vote or he does something completely counter to what he said he was going to do, you should let people know that. And, you don't do it in an attackful manner. You're not attacking him, but you're saying, hey, look, he said this. He took this action against what he said. against what he campaigned on, and you let people know that, and then you take it to the ballot box just like 65 was. 65 pushed through medical marijuana discussion because people took action at the ballot box.
And they were still thwarted.
They were. But I'll tell you, even if we're, you know, we'll talk about the special session in a minute because I think that's not going to happen. I don't think a special session is going to happen. And I'll talk about why in a minute. But even if it doesn't, when we come to January, it will happen.
Yeah.
Medical marijuana will pass. You know, there's the new bill out. I've got some qualms about the new bill. I've got issues with it. But at the end of the day, if it passed as is, it wouldn't be a horrible bill. It would just be a somewhat bad bill. But you would start getting people medical marijuana that they need, and that would have never happened without 65. I know lots of people put lots of money and time and effort into 65, and we were all very, you know, emotionally crushed when they threw it out, you know, when the Supreme Court threw it out. But the reality is we never would have had medical marijuana in 2022, January 2022, if that's when it happens. We still would have never had that without the work and dedication of the people who were behind 65.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I mean.
So it did change. It affected change, you know, through the ballot box, through work, through things. But, you know, during 65, their campaign was not about bashing the legislature. It was not about yelling, let's go to the legislature and yell at them because they haven't been pushing this. They said, okay, well, if the legislature's not going to do this, we'll do it our own way.
Right, but the legislature is poised right now, along with Tate Reeves, to do something that will make people more likely to go scream at them and to hate the system. So, you know, the problem that I have, and I am conceding your point because it's the same here. You know, if somebody wants to call up and have a debate with me on the air, I love those things. I'll have somebody in that chair you're sitting in any time to talk about socialism or disagree with me on any single issue. I love a good debate, but it has to be calm. And if somebody calls up and screams, I'll cut them off of the air and I'll dump their call. So, you know, I live in that world of, you know, respectful debate is absolutely fine with me. But it has just gotten to a point where, you know, the legislature or the politician might be aggrieved because you called them a name or called them out on social media or you came from them with bad tax. So they're aggrieved. Well, the citizen is aggrieved because things are not being done that need to be done. There are things that a lot of people are upset about are not being addressed. So there's two aggrieved parties. And what it comes down to is they have the power, so we need to change our behavior. They get to stay doing, you know, we're having to play their game. And you and I talked about the game should be flipped. It should be the politician that is trying to figure out how to work the people. That's even a deceptive word. The politician should be playing our game. And,
sure.
You know, how you flip that is the problem.
Right. And yeah. It is the problem. So, you know, until we can have that flip, you know, we are in the system we're in now, and so how do we affect change? So if the politician is doing something to make the constituent mad, and then the constituent just turns around and makes the politician mad, where have we gotten and what change are we going to do? You know, if the constituent is the better person in it, even though the politician does what he said he wasn't going to do, if the constituent then, you know, with cordiality, goes up to the politician and says, hey, this is why I think you made a bad vote. These are the facts. This is my position. And you got to understand these politicians are making 500 votes a year on 500 bills, some of them being 1,200 pages long, and they just do whatever somebody tells them to do. So if
that's the problem.
Well, I agree. That's the problem. But if you can go up being cordial with the facts and tell them, hey, this is why I think you should vote for this or against this, they may say, yeah, I'm with you. Hadn't had time to read the bill. They threw it at me last minute. You know, I'm glad that you are an expert, that you have the insight to do that, and you know, you've okay. come to me with facts, and I can do that.
Well, let me ask you this. So I go up, I talk to my legislator, he says, and I agree with you. They can't know everything about every single bill, and so they may learn something from people. And I'll grant you, although I almost find it hard to believe, I'll grant you that they are open to learning something new from some what they might see as a rube off the street. But anyway, so you go up there, you sway this person, he says, oh, yeah, I'm definitely going to vote yes on this. I had no idea. But then he gets a call from Speaker Gunn's office that says, oh, no, you're voting no on this. And so everything that you did, all your cordiality, all of these things that you did to play their game, Speaker Gunn just comes in and goes, no, we're a no on this. You vote yes on this, you're off of the committees that you try
to get. That's when he exposes it. That's when you go and say,
okay,
and that's
exposed.
What we do. That's why we have, yeah. You know, we have you know, our scorecard that shows accountability for people easily to pull up and see what votes they made.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, that's how you do it. And when I can tell you when those politicians start getting calls from their constituents, you know, one person, one, you know, you use the term rube, came up and talked to them and they voted against the way they told that one person. Well, that one person goes and tells, you know, 50 of their constituents.
Okay. All right.
And the 50 starts, you know, calling the politician saying, hey, I heard you said this and then voted against that. Why'd you do that? And then those 50 call 50 others. And so then he starts looking at, am I going to get reelected? That's number one thing politicians want.
Which re-election. Is disgusting.
Reelection.
I know.
They're always
That's
looking
gross.
At reelection. They're yeah. looking at reelection. So if they look at, hey, I'm going to be on the outs with the speaker if I take this vote, but I'm also not going to win reelection if I take the vote this way because the constituents are the ones who decide whether they get reelected or not. I can guarantee you they will go to the speaker, and it happens all the time, and says, look, speaker, I would love to be with you on this, but look, I've had this many people call me. I've talked about it on the air before. There's a 10 times.
Yeah.
You know, so five people call him, he's going to go to the speaker and say, I've had 50 people call me. You
yeah.
know, or if you have, you know, 100 people call, he's going to say, look, I've had 1,000 people call me over this. You know, so they'll find their ways. You know, they're still playing their game. They're still trying to find ways to get a bill passed. But if he can go and say that and say, look, I've heard from this many people, if enough of those politicians come to the speaker and say, look, we just can't do it. We can't vote on this because our constituents are going to come out against us. They will stand up, and they've done that before.
Okay.
And they'll go in a caucus meeting, and they'll discuss bills. If they don't think they have the votes to do it, they'll go into a Republican caucus meeting. They'll say, raise of hands, who's voting for this or who's out? Privately, and it's private. It's not a caucus meeting. It's very closed. You know, but they'll raise their hands, who's voting for it, who's against it. And if the caucus can't pass it, they won't bring it up.
Real quick, when it comes to reelection, what is more important to most politicians? Money to be able to run a campaign and get their name out there and do the marketing and that kind of stuff, or voter support? That may sound stupid, but you know, because in Mississippi, because you're in such a conservative place and you've got this two-party monopoly on stuff, you get a lot of sway just by going, oh, you may not like everything I do, but what, you're going to vote for a Democrat? You're going to let the Democrat win? So it's like the two-party system for both parties are guilty of this. They can pretty much be unaccountable just with the threat of, well, the other party is going to take control if you don't send me up there. You may not like me, but do you really want this? And so they're able to ignore constituents in favor of just a good campaign with
yeah,
some
no,
money.
That's, I mean, that, you know, that's absolutely true. You have politicians that are either true to their principles, which they're very few and far between. If they have the support of their constituents, they don't really need that much money, and they'll get money from their constituents.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, they'll grassroots campaign fund, so they'll get donations from the grassroots. The people who don't have the support of their constituents, they're the ones going to lobbyists asking for money there because they're not going to make it otherwise.
What's do you have any idea on what the percentage of incumbent legislators are for reelection? You know, this is one of the big great
yeah,
things.
So there. I don't know about in Mississippi. I haven't run those federally in congressional seats. It's 92% reelection.
Yeah, yeah.
92%.
Everybody hates politicians. They can't stand Congress. They think both parties are corrupt, but yet we continue to 92% we reelect. Yeah. And it's always because of that threat. You may not like me, but the alternative is worse. That's the bedrock of our political system.
Yeah, that's the best argument they have sometimes.
Yeah. All right, we got to take a break. Talking to Stephen Utrosko, Americans for Prosperity. We're going to talk about medical marijuana. Tate Reeves in the special session. Stay with us.
Right into this world, all alone. God takes your soul.
All right, we are back talking to Stephen Utrosko, Americans for Prosperity. So we've only got, go a little bit longer here. We got any short subjects, anything that's not going to get us into the heat of battle for something? We're going to talk about the special session. Go ahead and
let's talk
mention
about
that,
it.
And then we'll dissect it on the other side of the break.
Yeah, so I don't think it's going to happen. I know you and I have been talking about this on there for 6 months now, trying to figure out when we thought it. And I think, you know, fairly early on, I said if it didn't happen by mid-October, I wouldn't see it happening. And here we are, mid-October. The governor said from the very beginning, if the legislature, if both sides, both chambers can come to an agreement on
Which
a
they
bill,
did.
If they will come to an agreement on a bill, then I will call a special session. So it took them a long time to come on up with an agreement, but that was, I think it was, last week of September, September 24th or something like that, was when the bill was transferred to the governor's office.
Yeah.
Officially transferred. So you know, Lee Yancey on the House side. He's drug policy chairman. Kevin Blackwell on the Senate side, which, you know, we all probably remember Kevin Blackwell because he introduced his crony medical marijuana bill during session this year. But the two of them have been meeting hand in hand. Disclosure, I've been friends with Lee Yancey for 20 years. I've known Lee for a long time. He's a great traditional conservative. He stands up, you know, physical issues he's very good on, medical issues he's very good on. I wasn't sure how he was going to be on medical marijuana. He is a bivocational Baptist pastor, and he used to work for the Southern Baptist Convention in some capacity. But he actually came out, and he has been, I think, the best advocate for medical marijuana in the legislature.
Wow.
So, you know, I can't say enough good things about what I think he has been doing on his side of things on the House side. Certainly he's been fighting the Senate on their side. But they finally came to an agreement, came out with the bill. The bill's not perfect, but it's I think it's good enough that we need to pass it and get it going.
So Tate has had this bill for 3 weeks just sitting on it, and now he's
– Right.
What is he,
That's
just
right.
quiet?
So, yeah, so what? This – so well, he has been quiet basically until this week, and then just yesterday – he came out and made some statements, and basically he wants all these things changed about the bill now. He said, you know, originally he said, hey, if the legislature agrees on it, send it up to me, I'll look at it, and as long as there's nothing, you're just absolutely horrid about it, I'll call the special session. And here he is now, you know, 3 weeks later, after he's had 3 weeks to review it, and this is where Dobbs comes in too. Dobbs wants the amount of marijuana reduced, the amount of marijuana that you can get. So 65 was about 5 ounces per month. The bill that's now proposed is 4 ounces per month. They want it reduced even more. And what's really strange about it is anybody that knows anything about the marijuana industry knows that the industry standard is 1/8 of an ounce. Like that's a unit that they use, 1/8 of an ounce. That's basically how they sell things. Just like for alcohol, you have fifths.
Right.
Or you have, you know, pints or quarts or, you know, half gallons or whatever. There's certain industry standards. So they want to reduce it so that it's like the equivalent of about 2/3 of an 1/8, which is a very odd, you know, where they come up with, you know, it's just random, some random number they came up with. But it's like it would be as if the state came out and said, hey, we're no longer supporting, you know, us selling alcohol in fifths or quarts or pints. We want you to do it in 20-ounce containers.
Yeah, we want to take all beers down to 8-ounce beers, only sell pony beers here.
Right, yeah, something like that. Yeah. Or even worse than that, because a pony is actually an industry standard that they sell as 8 ounces. Yeah. It'd be like them coming out and saying, no, we want to sell 10-ounce beers. We're going to limit it at 10 ounces.
Yeah.
Like, well, nobody in the industry uses a 10-ounce bottle or 10-ounce measurement. Why would you do that?
What's Dobbs... Has he made a statement about this?
I mean, he has certainly talked about it. I don't know if there's any reasoning behind it other than they just want to reduce the amount. They think that's too much for people to have. The other thing that's big that they've come out with, so Lee Yancey basically stood up and said, no, we're not doing that. That's an industry standard. We're not changing that. That makes no sense whatsoever. We're not doing that. We're not accepting your term on that.
So is Thomas Dobbs doing something so deliberately stupid as to try to derail this thing? I mean,
well,
I
think it's been pretty obvious.
That stupid.
Yeah, I think it's been pretty obvious the entire time, even after 65 passed, when he was, you know, Department of Health was coming up with the regs about it, that he wanted nothing to do with it. You know, Thomas Dobbs wanted nothing to do with marijuana. And so I think that's just continuing that he has, you know.
Is Thomas Dobbs on the take from the pharmaceutical companies? I mean, I'm serious about this. Are they building him homes? Has he got summer homes? Is he flying a private jet with a friggin' Pfizer logo on the tail?
Yeah, I don't know that. That's a good question, though. That's good to look into it. But the other thing they want to do is Mississippi, with this bill, will be one of the only states that has a THC limit in it. Now, the THC limit on flower is very high, you know, in this bill, so it really wouldn't affect anything. For concentrate, it's, you know, not quite as high, but it still wouldn't affect most things. So it's not really that big of a deal having the concentrate limits on it. But of course, they're coming out. That's the other thing. They want to reduce the amount you can get per month, and they want to reduce the THC percentage that can go into the products, which would, you know, basically make us a more stringent medical marijuana program than any other state in the country. And so I want to read a quote that Lee Yancey says, if he doesn't want to call a special session for this, we will do it on the first week of January in regular session, and he can deal with it after we pass it. This delay is not because of the legislature. The delay is because the governor keeps coming to us with unreasonable demands.
Yeah. So this is all on Tate Reeves.
This is Tate Reeves right now. He is the one that is delaying this. Like I said, I trust Lee Yancey. I have looked at the bill, have read the bill. There's things about it I don't agree with or I wish would change, specifically the taxing portion of it I think is outrageous. But I would take it as it is now so that we can start getting people the medication that they need, and we can work on changing it in January if we need to. But it doesn't matter. It's all being derailed by the governor, who at the last minute, you know, at the last hour, they've been working on this for 6 months now, and he hasn't been involved at all. And then at the last minute, they sent it to him. He said, oh, I want all these unreasonable things in it.
Does Tate Reeves, I mean, does he want to quit? I think people would be fine if he just stepped down. It seems to me maybe he just didn't really want to be governor. Like, he got it, and it's just not as cool as he thought it was going to be. So he's doing essentially nothing. He's staying silent. Is he not happy with it? I mean, does he have a snowball's chance in hell of being reelected?
Yeah, you know, you and I were talking off air, and if you look at the big picture of Tate Reeves when he was lieutenant governor, he was one of the best lieutenant governors we had had in a long time, you know, especially on fiscal issues. I mean, he constantly cut down budgets. He constantly killed bond bills, which you and I have talked about a lot, the $1,200-page, you know, $600 million bond bills that they passed. I mean, he single-handedly killed that three of his 8 years.
And he was a disruptor, wasn't he? Yeah, he was aggressive.
I mean, there was, you know, certainly several issues, several topics like, you know, vaccines that that he did not support, you know, changing our vaccine schedules and things like that. So a lot of people were mad at him for that. But if you look at the big picture, especially on the fiscal side of things, he was the best lieutenant governor we had for a long time. So there was nothing on that side of it to think that he wouldn't go into this office being a very strong governor and a very liberty-minded governor, at least like DeSantis has been, or, you know, Kristi Noem or somebody like that. But it just hasn't happened. You know, he came in, and in his first year, I feel bad for him a little bit. I mean, he bought into this.
He got the brass ring.
You know,
and then
his first year, there was a hurricane that hit. There's tornadoes that hit. Then COVID hit. Nobody knew anything about it. And so, I mean, he had a, you know, very hard first year.
Yeah.
So you can't blame too much for anything he did the first year. But as he came out of that,
we've all adjusted.
You know, now we're 2 years into his term now. You're 2 years in, and this, at least this second year, he has done very little. He has done very little standing up and talking. He's been
I barely hear from him.
I know he's you know, the word hermit is used about him in the political circles a lot.
Doesn't he have further political aspirations? I assume he was going to go from governor to senator to, I mean, I felt like this guy was some kind of a, and I don't know the system anywhere like you do, but I felt like he was a political beast, that these were
all
stepping stones.
Sure.
Well, he sure as hell looks like he's about to hit a dead end if he doesn't do something and fast. And this medical marijuana may be the final nail in his political coffin.
Well, I tell you what, the prospects for other gubernatorial candidates that are looking at 23 aren't any better.
Yeah.
So I'm not sure where we're going to be at that.
Yeah. Gosh. Okay. Well, Thomas Dobbs strikes again. This man needs to be fired. He needs to be fired immediately. And then, in my opinion, he should be embarrassed to show his face in this state ever again. But I doubt any of that will happen. We'll
be right back. I tear my heart open. I sew myself shut. My weakness is that I can't do much. And my scars remind me that the past is real. I tear my heart open.
All right, we are back. This is the Mike Madison Show, 103.9 WYAB. We're talking to Stephen Utroska from Americans for Prosperity. There are some other things going on with the legislature that are percolating. Medicare expansion is one of the biggies. They weren't they trying to do a ballot petition for Medicare expansion?
Medicaid expansion.
Medicaid, excuse me. And that got derailed because they stopped the process.
But it did.
Through the legislature, are they talking about Medicare expansion?
I think I've said on the show before that that our lieutenant governor, Delbert Hoseman, has been, even during his campaigning as a Republican for lieutenant governor in 19, you know, on the campaign trail was saying, hey, I'm open to Medicaid expansion. And so, you know, he's still using kind of that term, you know, oh, I'm open to hearing the conversation about it.
But he's for it.
We all know that means he's for it. And so, you know, I'm really looking forward to, you know, I went to the rally this last weekend for medical freedom, and I'm really hoping that those same people, when we get into the Medicaid fight, that, you know, that's still medical freedom. Yeah. So I'm hoping they'll you know, continue on with the medical freedom, pass the mandates, and help us fight Medicaid expansion. But, yeah, so Delbert Hosemann has been, you know, a supporter of Medicaid expansion for several years now.
Why? What is it for him? I mean, what benefit is it? Does he think it somehow takes?
Oh, Mike, that's free money. Why would we turn down free money? Nobody has to pay for that, right? I mean, that's just free government money, you know, and it's going to help his buddies at the hospital association. You know,
that's what I was going to get
to. It's a bailout. Yeah. You know, it's basically a hospital bailout program.
Yeah. Why does that mean that, like, there aren't any people who can't pay anymore, essentially, that everybody that comes can at least pay something because the hospitals are losing money on the uninsured?
Yeah, it's because we already have such a restricted healthcare market.
Right, yeah.
You know,
they create the problem.
Yeah, and then, it's all about compassion, though. You got to get – everybody needs health care. That's a right, isn't it?
Yeah.
Isn't that a right?
Unless you're unvaccinated. If you're unvaccinated, you should die in the ditch.
Yeah, so, you know, he's been on support, but what happened yesterday that was big that came out was Chad McMahon's a senator from up north, like in the Tupelo area. He came out on another radio talk show from your favorite radio station, WGOP,
yeah,
and said – basically, I'm open to talking. He's a Republican now. Yeah. Chad McMahon, Republican.
Probably said, really conservative.
Oh.
Very conservative.
Very.
Yeah.
Certainly when he's on the campaign trail.
Yeah. Carries a constitution, all that good stuff.
Yeah.
Gotcha.
So he came out and said, well, look, you know, I'm open to talking about Medicaid expansion. And, you know, I mean, Medicaid's not really a welfare program anyways. And then he goes on to, like, perfectly explain what a welfare program is. Yeah, so he's saying, you know, oh, it's not really welfare. It's this, which sums up perfectly how it's a welfare program.
Yeah.
So when you have Republicans that are out there, you know, talking about things like that, saying, oh, yeah, we should pass this because it's not, I mean, it's not, you know, if we just change the meaning of words to mean what we want it to mean, then it's not what it used to mean.
So these politicians are carrying water for somebody. They're representing a special interest when they're saying these words and opening us up to this. What special interests want Medicaid expansion? So the Hospital Association?
Hospital Association, 100%.
That's it. They want it.
Yep.
So
yep.
Yeah.
I mean, you have people who are not like-minded to us who believe that there's such a thing as free government money. That nobody has to pay for. It's not going to cost anybody anything.
Right,
you know?
But those are just people. I'm talking about people who have influence in the legislature, which means they've got a bunch of money. So
it's
the Hospital Association.
Hospital Association,
As I refer to, around the medical mafia.
Yeah, and so some of the hospital associations, they have actually a very good lobbyist. He's very good. But he's going around giving these speeches, these talks about how, oh, we have to do this for the compassion of people, and all of our hospitals are just going to close down. If we don't do this, you wouldn't want that, would you?
Does he mention how much extra money the hospitals will make? Does he give a figure to that?
Oh, yeah, he does. He's not you know, ashamed of that because he's saying this is how much the hospitals are going to bring in, but if we don't do this, they're all going to close.
Of course.
They're going to go out of business.
Yeah.
So we have to do this.
Oh, gotcha. So basically, hospitals cannot exist without the government. It seems like that's a flawed business model to me.
Yeah, well, that's because we have such things like certificate of need laws that don't allow anybody but hospitals to open doors.
Right.
You know, the hospitals already own a monopoly on the system. And so, of course, they have a lot of sway because if they've created laws that only allow them to operate, and then they come back and say, if you don't do this, we will close down.
That's quite a game they got going.
Isn't it?
I mean, you got to hand it to them. It is quite a clever thing. Create the problem. And then profit from the solution for the problem that you created.
Yep, I mean, that's it.
I got to figure out how to implement that in my own life somehow.
Well, that's the whole thing. Have you seen the you on socialism and your politician on socialism? It's like you're living in a rundown shack and then your politician's living in a great big mansion.
Right. Yeah.
That's it.
Yeah.
They're making the laws and they're making themselves put in a position to where they have to be supported. So the hospitals put in the game so that they have a monopoly, and then they put it in the game so that it looks like they're failing unless you do this. So they're all getting rich and everybody else is getting poor.
Yeah.
And that's how it works.
Yeah.
That's how socialism works.
Right. Well, that's Obamacare and the health insurance industry. It was very interesting to watch that. All the, oh, woe is me on health insurance stuff. And then They came in and health insurers' profits tripled right after Obamacare. Yet people still believe it was Barack Obama and his compassion for people that passed that bill.
Yeah.
Had nothing. It was written by a health insurance lobbyist in Max Baucus's office, signed off on. She was a former executive with health insurance industry. She writes this thing. Their profits triple within 3 years, as Rand Paul has pointed out, and was still the law of the land.
Yeah.
And strangely, well, Republicans haven't gotten rid of it. Didn't you find that odd?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
When they've had plenty of opportunities
they
to
have.
Do that.
Yeah, they just always come a bit short from that. All right. We're going to take one more break. We'll come back and finish up talking to Stephen Utroska, Americans for Prosperity. Stay with us.
From all over the world, this is Captain America calling. I built you up when you were down on your knees. So will you catch me now? I'm falling.
All right, we're back. This is the Mike Madison Show, 103.9 WYAB. We're talking to Stephen Utroska, Americans for Prosperity. We got one final segment here, Stephen. So we didn't finish with Medicaid. You believe that's going to happen for Mississippi?
Yeah, I think it's going to happen. I mean, the feds right now, in some of these spending bills that they're coming out with right now, they actually have a provision in one of them that would essentially expand Medicaid into the holdout states anyways. At least the benefit to, our side of things would be that if they do that, that then, doesn't put the burden of paying for it on the state. The feds would pay for it. And so, my concern has always been if we expand Medicaid, not only has it always cost states more than they ever thought, the projections are always, under what ends up happening.
Like everything. Yeah.
Yeah, like everything. But right now they're at 90. The federal government paid 90% of the expansion. Well, they could decide tomorrow that, hey, we're cutting that back to 60%, and
right,
then you're left holding the bag if you chose to expand it.
But Delbert Hosman's okay with that.
Right. Yeah, of course he is. But if the feds expand it and they're paying 100% of it,
yeah,
and then they come back and say, well, we're going to cut that back to 60. Well, we've never accepted that.
Right.
So then we can go back and say, well, no, we're not paying for that. We've never accepted those terms. And, the people who are on the expansion part of it would then just lose their health care or I don't know, maybe they could pay the difference. But
I
think it's coming one way or the other. I don't think we can stop it as long as Democrats are in control. But we can at least stop us agreeing to it and putting us on the tab for that.
This may be a little bit too long of a subject to get into, but I'm very interested in it. The way things are going right now, it almost feels like there's going to be some kind of a national breakup at some point. I mean, we are so divergent in ideas and philosophies. I mean, some people want to defund their police departments. You can't coexist in a society like this. Just we're too far apart on so many things. Is there any way Mississippi could ever be an independent state, could actually stand up to an overreaching federal government because of the fact we are so on the dole from the feds?
Yeah, so if you look at our budget, we have about a $6.5 billion state budget. That's our state revenue. We get about this is pre-COVID years. I'm not talking about COVID.
Yeah.
Pre-COVID years, we were at about $16 billion for the feds.
Okay, well,
$6.5 billion state, $16 billion feds, how much money? So, I mean, we literally have...
So we're a quarter. So they pay three-quarters of our bills every year?
That's right.
Yeah.
So now the money they send down to us is specifically allocated. We have no control
right.
over that, but it goes to roads, education, things like that, Medicaid, Medicare, those things. So, I mean, they're earmarks. We can't afford it. But if they were to cease to exist... That means we'd have to cut out that much. We'd have to cut out, two-thirds or three-quarters of our, spending that we have in the state of Mississippi, or we couldn't exist.
But and I'm sure there's almost no appetite for that at the political level. I mean, I'm just really,
I'm with you. I mean, that's something I've thought about myself. If we balkanize, if every state becomes its own, state.
Right. An actual, really kind of how it's supposed to be.
Yeah, how it's supposed to be. If we became our own state and we didn't have a federal government, we weren't part of a union anymore, and we weren't getting those big dole dollars coming down to us, could we exist? And do I trust that our politicians who are at the state level could cut that amount to make us a sovereign state? I don't know.
Yeah, well,
I don't know that I have confidence in them to be able to do that.
Well, I mean, we're just getting to a point now where what's coming out of the federal government has just become so draconian and real potential infringements on people's rights that, I know there's a lot of people in the in the legislature that might want to fight it. But yeah, I mean, we have become, and is there ever an attempt to wean us off those dollars, or is every federal dollar that comes in just championed and cheered for because they get to, you know, spend less?
It's free money.
Yeah.
So, why wouldn't we take it?
But states like, I guess, so Florida could do something. Florida is probably a net depositor too, rather
right.
than a benefit.
Yeah,
Texas,
that's right.
Is a net giver. You know, so we are, I don't know, other states, Alabama, Louisiana, Arkansas, Tennessee, do you know where they stand? Are they all welfare children
too?
Think
we're all, I think most of the Southeast states except for Florida and Texas are pretty much net gainers from federal dollars, not givers.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I don't know where we would, you know, I mean, we would have to change radically in the state. But I don't, you know, if you look at our, you see us as a very red, dark red state, but we're actually very split. You know, we're about a 40-60 state. We have a 60%, so that keeps us red. But if you look at 40-60, that means if we went all on our own, all, you know, just the state making decisions, there's 40% of the people out there who would not want to change a thing about the way we spend money.
Yeah.
And then the other 60% that are red, I don't know if they really want to change it either.
Right, yeah. It doesn't appear so.
So, that's a tough topic to talk about because I just don't know. I don't know how we would have to change.
Yeah.
But I don't know what that would look like. I certainly don't think we're in a position as good as many other states are because we're so federally dependent. And, you know, I don't know. I mean,
Well, when you've got a president that is actually out there mandating that companies over 100 people force their employees to take this shot, you can certainly see a government that would come in and say your federal dollars are now tied to your vaccination numbers or any of these
Absolutely.
Kinds of things, too.
100%.
So, you know, Mississippians, conservative Mississippians want to be protected against that, and it doesn't seem we got the legislature that's going to do it.
Yeah, I mean, you just look at alcohol laws. You know, back in the day, Louisiana didn't want to change to 21,
right.
and the feds came down and said, all right, we're cutting out all your federal infrastructure dollars. We're not giving you more money for highways.
Speed limits did the
so
same
So they can
thing.
Do that, and they
yeah.
will.
Yeah.
They will. Because yeah. I've done it before.
All right. Well, only got about 15 seconds. Anything AFP you need to talk about?
We're still doing our GLA. Come out. Go on our foundation Facebook page and find out more. We've got two more weeks of it. If you haven't come before, come out and see the last 2 weeks.
Be good to come out there and just meet some of the people there. There's great people in that class. So anyway, been talking to Stephen Utroska, Americans for Prosperity, and we'll see him again next week. Talk to everybody tomorrow. Bye-bye.
No matter how hard you try, you can't stop us now. No matter how hard you try, you can't stop us now.